As you can see from the screen, the title of the lesson this morning is Little Sins. And I will tell you up front that the point of this lesson is, if I may put it in the form of the question, if God hates even what people might think of as little sins and would punish them, how much more so would He hate and punish those which might be regarded as big sins? There are no sins, therefore, that we should feel comfortable committing. Now, the concept of little sins allows people to think that there are some sins that are so small that they are inconsequential. People think, in this case, that God cares no more about such sins than they do. And therefore, there are sins, they think, that they can commit with impunity. That is, sins that will not be punished. So this allows them, and this is the appeal of making this category headed by the title, Little Sins. This allows them, they think, the pleasure of indulging in such sins without any sense of fear that they will be punished with them, without any sense of guilt that they've really done anything terribly wrong. Now, the fact that the Bible acknowledges that some sins are worse than others gives some credibility to this idea of there being such things as little sins. I mean, after all, it stands to reason that if some parts of God's law are weightier or more important than others, as Jesus indicates in Matthew 23, verse 23, and also Matthew 22, verse 38, that there is the greatest commandment in the law. This may lead some people to think that, okay, if there are these greater commandments, then there must be lesser commandments, and we can disobey the lesser commandments. That's the way they might reason. Also, Jesus acknowledged when He was speaking to Pilate in John 19, verse 11, that the ones who had delivered Him up to Pilate, the Roman governor, for crucifixion, for condemnation, were the ones with the greater sin. So, I acknowledge, and because the Bible acknowledges, that there are greater sins and therefore there might be lesser sins. But the fact that there are lesser sins doesn't mean that there are little sins, particularly sins that we should feel free to commit are sins that God will not take note of and will not punish. We should not think in that way. There are some problems with this concept of little sins. First of all, it allows people to classify these sins arbitrarily. Arbitrarily. I mean, who is to say what is a little sin and what is a big sin? Considering that God doesn't see things as we see things ought to teach us that, listen, just because we might consider a sin to be a little sin doesn't mean that that's the way God looks at it. Also, the person who concerns himself with little sins has a bad attitude toward sin. The Bible nowhere uses the expression big sins. It nowhere uses the expression big sins or little sins. Though one sin might be greater or worse than another, that doesn't mean that it is little. I mean, I would grant that murdering someone is worse than getting a ticket for speeding. I would agree with that. But that doesn't mean that speeding is okay. Any sin is serious because what is sin? Basically, it represents a disregard for God's law. It represents disrespect, if not contempt, toward God. So, from that standpoint, no sin, therefore, can be considered a little sin. So, the very concept of little sins and the effort to identify them with the implication that it is acceptable to commit them, all of that is wrong. No one with the right attitude toward God and the right attitude toward obedience to God tries to size up or categorize sin and put it in one category or another. We all recognize that sin, if we have the attitude we should have, is something that ought to be avoided. Now, if Jesus did not really think that ignoring any part, even what might be considered the small parts of God's law, then do we have the right to call any sins little sins? Notice what he said in a Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, the 5th chapter, verses 18 and 19. There he makes the point. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Yeah, there might be commandments that people consider to be the least of the commandments. Did Jesus say, because they're little commandments, and violating them would only involve you in little sins, that therefore you should feel free to go on and commit and break those commandments? No. He said, if you do that, you'll be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Jesus spoke about people, the Pharisees who would strain out a gnat and swallow a camel in Matthew 23, verse 24. Now, that doesn't mean that he would agree that it's all right to swallow gnats. You don't want to swallow a camel, some people might say, but it's all right to swallow gnats. That's not what Jesus said. I don't know about you, but I don't even want a gnat. I don't want any kind of bug in any milk that I drink. So, just because Jesus condemns swallowing a camel, that doesn't mean it's all right to swallow a gnat. That was not his point there. But also, the concept of little sins builds a tolerance for those sins and even greater sins. Little sins desensitize a person to the concept of sin. Little sins, we've heard of gateway drugs, that is, drugs that people start with and it leads to an acceptance of stronger drugs. Well, little sins can become a gateway to greater sins. And thus, as it says in Ecclesiastes 10, verse 1, a little foolishness destroys much good. And as it says in Galatians 5, verse 9, a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. No, we don't even want that little leaven of sin in our lives. We should not, anyway. And especially, let's notice what is said in Luke 16, the last part of verse 10. I realize angels already read this, and I appreciate that, but for purposes of emphasis, this pretty well is a theme verse, and therefore I want to turn back to it and look at it again for that reason. Verse 10 says, he who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. You know, there is a theory called the broken window theory. It's a sociological theory. And the idea is that, you know, if, say, windows in a broken windows in an abandoned factory or even an abandoned house, a structure of any kind, are broken. One or two are broken. But therefore, people coming along, say maybe kids, maybe not kids, but anyway, people come along, they say, oh, it's abandoned, it's got broken windows, nobody cares. They will pick up rocks and they will break the other windows and they don't care. Or they, in other ways, they will vandalize that building. And the broken window theory says that if you ignore even the little things that are wrong, it will encourage people to do worse things. On the theory that, oh, you know, nobody cares about these little things, so we can move on and do even worse things than that. And the point of the story is, listen, you need to take care of the little things, because if you don't take care of the little things, that's going to encourage people to do even worse things. And that's essentially what Jesus is saying here. You cannot afford to ignore any sins. Because that's going to encourage the idea, oh, if we can commit this sin, then we can commit that sin. No, any sin, regardless of what people might think, is its size, big or little, we need to be concerned about. Last point here I want to make as far as problems with the concept of little sins is that all sins, even those considered small or little, will be punished. Jesus said that even those who committed sins in ignorance committed deeds worthy of punishment. Let's look in, well, we're in Luke 16. Let's turn back several pages to the 12th chapter of Luke. And we'll look in verses 47 and 48. It says there, Luke 12, verses 47 and 48, "And that slave who knew his master's will and did not get ready or act in accord with his will shall receive many lashes. But the one who did not know it and committed deeds worthy of flogging will receive but few. And from everyone who has been given much shall much be required, and to whom they have entrusted much of him they will ask all the more." Now, he makes two distinctions here, or rather one distinction, between one who knew his master's will and the other who did not know his master's will. Now, the one who did not know his master's will but committed deeds worthy of flogging, he says he's going to receive just a few strokes. But here's my point now, and there's a lot in that passage I know we could discuss, but for purposes of this lesson, let me just make the point here that even the one who got the few strokes got strokes. Okay? So he was punished. He was punished. So even those that might be committed, considered small infractions or offenses were punished. The ones that might be considered excusable by virtue of the fact that he was ignorant of them, even those were punished. Let's look now at some, having stated those general principles, let's look now at some biblical examples of of sins that by people today, particularly, might be considered little sins, and let's see how God dealt with them so that we might destroy this idea that we're free to commit those sins that we think are little sins. And you've heard of little white lies? People do have that concept. You know, some sins are just too little that, you know, for God to be concerned about, therefore, if God's not concerned about them, we don't need to be concerned about them. And my ultimate point is, if God's going to deal seriously with those sins that people might consider even to be little, then think about those sins that people might consider to be big, and how He's going to deal with them. But first of all, I'm sorry, or did I? I must have overlooked some points here. Yes, I did. I apologize for that. And this was a point I did not want to overlook. I was about to rush over to my outline. But let me back up, if you'll permit me, just a moment before we look at those biblical examples. When God destroyed the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis, the 19th chapter, because of their wickedness, you know, He rained fire and brimstone upon them. Lot and his family were there. But through the mercy of God, Lot and his wife and two daughters were allowed to escape. Actually, shortly thereafter, his wife, as you know, if you know the story, was turned into a pillar of salt because she looked back upon the city as it was being destroyed. So Lot and his two daughters went on. And Lot was just, and you can imagine why this would be the case, he was terrified in that situation. His home city of Sodom was being destroyed by fire and brimstone, being rained down from heaven. And he wanted to seek refuge somewhere. And he besought God to allow him to find refuge from the firestorm in the city of Zoar. And he says in the 19th chapter, verse 20, "Is it not small?" It's a small. Now, why did Lot say that? Why did he make that argument for being able to go and seek refuge in the city of Zoar? Is it not small? Well, apparently, the city of Sodom not only the city of Sodom, but the city of Zoar, I should say, was slated for destruction. We see from Genesis, the 14th chapter, in verse 8, that there was, in this region, a five-city coalition or alliance. Actually, let's go over there and look at that. Well, I can tell you there was Sodom and Gomorrah, but there was also a city by the name of Adma, another city, a fourth city, by the name of Zeboiim, and a fifth city by the name of Zoar. It had before been named Bela, but its name was changed to Zoar. Is it not small? Zoar was apparently the smallest of those cities in that five-city alliance. And actually, people may think only the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. But in a couple of passages, one that I have cited here, Deuteronomy 29, verse 23. Actually, the other one is in Hosea 11, verse 8. It mentions not only Sodom and Gomorrah, but also the third and fourth cities, Adma and Zeboiim, were also destroyed. So it wasn't just two cities, four cities were destroyed. And here's the point. Here's the point. Zoar, apparently, in that five-city coalition, was also slated for destruction. God was going to destroy Zoar, too. And so when Lot says, can I flee there? And his argument is it not small? And this is where it relates to the study. He was basically saying, listen, I know this city is sinful also. It's slated for destruction, but it's a small city, Lord. So spare this city destruction so I can seek refuge there. And the passage goes on to say, I grant you this request. In other words, okay, I was going to destroy Zoar, but because you've requested it, you can go there. And I won't destroy it. Now, isn't that interesting? Some people might say, well, Zoar, you know, it's sinful, but it's a small sinful city. So, Lord, you don't need to trouble yourself with this small, wicked city. You've got these bigger wicked cities to deal with that you can really concern yourself with. Not this small, sinful city of Zoar. That's not the way God originally looked at it. Even though Zoar was small, it was sinful. It was sinfully small, and He still took note of it and was still going to destroy that city until Lot made his request on the basis, is it not small? Okay, having made that point, that God has shown Himself to care about even little sins or little instances of sin, now we can go on and look at those biblical examples. Okay, the first of these, and I'm going to go through these pretty quickly here. The first of these is the very first sin. What was the first sin? It was eating the forbidden fruit, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Adam and Eve did that. And some would say, well, you know, that wasn't so bad. I mean, what can possibly be wrong with eating fruit? Isn't fruit good for you? Aren't we encouraged to eat fruit? I mean, can you think of a smaller, more innocuous, or seemingly innocuous thing or action than eating fruit? Why make that a sin of all things? And yet it was a sin. And it was a sin, as you probably know, got Adam and Eve cast out of the Garden of Eden. They were deprived of life, or the perpetual extension of life anyway. By that, yes, this was, we might not think of it as a big deal, but God certainly did. Why? Adam and Eve's eating of the fruit that God had told them not to eat of represented something seriously wrong. It represented disrespect toward God. Disbelief of God. God had said, don't eat of that tree. You can eat out of all the others, but not this one. And so when they chose to do that, what did that mean about their attitude toward God? It meant they did not care about what God had said. And that's the point of sin. Even those sins that people might consider to be little sins, what they are is an expression of a disrespect for what God has said. And that in itself is what makes sin serious. There's also the example in Genesis, the 4th chapter, verses 1 through 12, of Cain's offering. Cain brought vegetable offerings while his brother brought of his livestock to sacrifice to the Lord. Apparently, God had told Cain and Abel, the sacrifices I want are animal sacrifices. Cain apparently decided not to do that. I don't really know what his reasoning was. The Bible doesn't tell us in detail what it was. But apparently he had the attitude, listen, I'm a farmer. Why is it my stuff as good as my brother's stuff? And, you know, apparently that ate at him so much that he eventually rose up and he killed his own brother Abel. Some people might think, well, you know, that was pretty petty on God's part to reject Cain's vegetable offering. I mean, what's wrong with that offering? After all, it was what he worked for. It was what he had to offer. What should have counted was the fact that Cain offered anything at all, and God should have accepted it. So they might think of Cain's infraction here, or his offense, as being something too small. And yet worship, what's the point of it? Isn't worship to show respect for God? Isn't worship, aren't we gathered here today to worship God by way of showing that we honor God, that we exalt Him, and as part of our exaltation of Him, we're going to do whatever He says, regardless of what we might otherwise think? And so worship that instead shows disrespect for what God says is really pointless. There's no point to it. If your worship is disrespectful worship, then you might as well not do it. Favoritism. Now, favoritism or partiality would be another word. It's not a good thing. But some people might think, well, it's not like you're killing anybody. So, you know, it's favoritism, if it's not a small sin, it's certainly not as big as some of these others. And, you know, God shouldn't be so concerned about favoritism or partiality. And yet favoritism or partiality has caused problems out of all proportion to its apparent size. Just a few examples from the Scriptures. Isaac's favoritism toward Esau over Esau's brother Jacob started a feud between these two brothers. And actually this feud went on down to their descendants. You might even think of it as, you know, the original Hatfields and McCoy feud. But yeah, even the Israelites who were descended from Jacob and the Edomites who were descended from Esau, even they fought against each other. And therefore, this was a feud started by a show of favoritism to one over the other. This was a feud that lasted in the history of the Edomites and the Israelites over 1,000 years. And then another example. Because Jacob loved his wife Rachel more than his wife Leah. Yes, he had not just two wives, but four wives. It led to conflict in his family. Also, to use another example, Jacob's favoritism toward his next to youngest son, out of 12, Joseph by name, led to a lot of jealousy on the part of Joseph's brothers toward him. And you may, again, well know the story. They sold Joseph, they kidnapped him, sold him into Egypt as a slave. That caused Jacob a lot of heartache. Caused the brothers, no doubt, heartache as they eventually regretted what they had done, apparently. Caused Joseph problems. So all these problems emanated from what? What people might consider to be the little sin of favoritism. Today, even my wife and I are concerned. She actually reminds me sometimes, you know, don't favor our granddaughter or grandson over our granddaughter, whatever, because one can get jealous toward the other. Try to be, you know, with our two children, one a son, one a daughter. We tried to be very even-handed about our expressions of love that we showed toward one, and when one might excel over the other, you got to be careful there. You got to be careful there because you don't want the other thinking, you know, they don't appreciate or love me or appreciate me more. So favoritism can be an easy thing to fall into, but we got to be careful about it. Now, in James, the second chapter, verses 1 through 18, the favoritism or the partiality shown there was very blatant. As a matter of fact, let's not consider it to be partiality or favoritism to be such a minor thing, because in courts of justice, it's an extremely serious offense to show partiality. And the law of Moses said to judges, "You shall not show partiality to the rich or to the poor." You got to be very even-handed and fair in issuing justice, issuing your judgments. So let's not say that favoritism or partiality is such a little sin. It can cause a lot of problems. And James points out that when you show favoritism among brethren, and you say to your poor brethren, you sit over here on the floor in the corner, and you say to the rich brother or the rich person who comes in, okay, you sit up front here in this special place of honor, that's partiality. And you can lose your soul over something like that. That's how serious it was. Let's be careful not to show favoritism, and this is not the point of my lesson, but even among our brethren, let's make sure that we, you know, try to get around to everybody. I know this is not always possible. Sometimes I get away from here and say, "Oh, I didn't greet so and so today," and I kind of feel bad about that because I'm afraid that person might feel slighted or something like that. But we do need to be concerned about treating our brethren, whoever they are, equally. Okay. Strange fire. In Leviticus 10, verses 1 through 3, it says that Nadab and Abihu were actually literally burned up by fire from the Lord because they had offered strange fire. Now, this was fire, and it goes on to say, it defined what the strange fire is, fire which had not been commanded by the Lord. Now, some people might think, "Oh, that seems to be such a little thing. Really, something of no consequence. Why should Nadab and Abihu be burned up because they didn't offer the incense at the right time or in the right way or whatever was wrong? Why should God be concerned about that? After all, one of the duties of the priest was to offer incense. And it just seems to be, in some people's minds, so wrong that Nadab and Abihu were killed here that I've actually known people to look for different reasons why God got upset at Nadab and Abihu here. And one of the things other people say, "Oh, it was really because they were drunk that God slew them." Well, they might have been drunk. And the reason they say this is because in the context, it actually says that the priest were to be careful not to drink before they went about their business as priest. Verse 9 says, and this is the Lord speaking to Aaron, "Do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you may not die. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations, so that you can make a distinction between the clean and the unclean," and so on. So some people judge from that, since that commandment is in this context, that you know, Nadab and Abihu must have been drunk. that might have been true. I don't know. It doesn't explicitly say that. I don't think it's a necessary inference. But in any event, the specific reason that we're given is that it was because they offered strange fire which God had not commanded them. This is in verse 1. So, in our service and our worship to God, God considers it, if I may use language we'd use today, a big deal whether or not we do according as He has directed. Their infraction of God's directions represented a lack of respect, if not contempt, for Him and His Word. I'm reminded of the statement of the Lord to the people after the Israelites returned from Babylonian exile is recorded in Malachi 1, verses 6 through 8. God said, "You have despised me," or "despised my altar." And as if they were eager, they said, "How have we despised thee?" I mean, you can imagine thinking, that's kind of a strong word, isn't it? "We despised you. How have we despised you?" He said, "By offering sacrifices, animal sacrifices of the lame and the blind and the blemished and so on." In other words, the point is, we despise God. We might not like to think that way, you might not think in those terms, but we despise God. We hold God in contempt when we think, God, in effect, this is what we're saying, you don't know what you're talking about. We do. Okay? So we can tweak, we can change what you've said because we're the ones who really know what we're talking about. So when we don't do what God says, when we disobey Him, we despise Him. We show contempt for Him. Also, there's the instance in Numbers 20 of Moses striking the rock. Now, some people think this is not a big deal. If you were to go to verses 7 through 12, you would see that God had told Moses, you know, take the rock, go out to the rock, because the Israelites are complaining again about not having any water, and speak to the rock and bring forth water for the Israelites and their livestock. Well, Moses didn't do exactly what God said. Now, the difference between what God said and what Moses did, to some people, is not a big deal. But God considered it a big deal. It was no little sin to God. That Moses struck the rock instead of merely speaking to it as God had commanded him seems like a small infraction. And that really doesn't require any punishment from God upon Moses. I mean, after all, people could argue this way. You know what? God had told him before. There was a similar instance recorded back in Exodus, the 17th chapter, where God had told Moses to strike the rock. So, you know, Moses could have reasoned, I know he said speak to it, but, you know, maybe he forgot back here. He told me to strike it, so I can strike it here too. This is the pattern. God did tell him to take the rod. Moses could have reasoned, well, he did tell me to take the rod, so he obviously expected me to do something with it, like strike the rock. God did cause water to flow forth from the rock, according to verse 11 of Numbers 20. So some people might say, well, God apparently didn't think it was a big deal because He allowed water to come out anyway. And some people might say, well, you know, there's some aggravating circumstances here. You know, the people got Moses pretty upset. And that's true. That's true. Sometimes people get so upset they forget themselves, as we sometimes say. In Psalm 106, verses 32 and 33, it does say Moses got angry. You know, he'd been putting up with these people for a while, like 40 years. And it appears. And it does say he spoke rashly with his lips. Yeah. And so, again, here's a situation where people try to find some other reason why God must have gotten so upset with Moses. They cannot believe that God would have gotten so upset that Moses would have struck the rock when God told him simply to speak to the rock. They cannot conceive of that being a big enough deal, a big enough sin, for God to have punished Moses by forbidding him to enter the promised land. So they find other reasons. Oh, it was his anger that was the problem. Okay? Oh, it was that he spoke rashly. Oh, it was that he gave himself credit by saying, shall we bring forth water from you out of this rock? Now, listen, all of those things may very well be true. They may have aggravated the sin. But the specific point at which Moses sinned or committed a sinful act or acted contrary to what God had explicitly told him was when he struck the rock instead of speaking to it. God said, speak to the rock, you struck it. Some people might consider that a small, inconsequential sin. God did not. Really, that's all I have to say about that. Saul's disobedience. There were actually a couple of times. We think about the big time when Saul sinned as being the time when God told him in 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, to go and destroy all of the Amalekites and their livestock. He didn't do that. He spared King Agag of the Amalekites. He spared the best of the livestock, supposedly for sacrifice. But there was another time before that when Saul had been instructed, 1 Samuel, the 13th chapter, he had been instructed by Samuel, wait 7 days and I'll come and I'll offer sacrifice. Instead, Saul, when he was faced with an imminent battle with the Philistines, got scared because Samuel wasn't showing up after 7 days to offer this sacrifice. And so he went ahead and offered the sacrifice himself. Then Samuel showed up and rebuked Saul for what he had done, for not waiting for him as he had been instructed. Now, what I'm trying to make here is that Saul's disobedience in both of these cases might have seemed to some people to be slight and excusable. In the first case, his situation seems to have been so desperate. I mean, he was about to join battle with the Philistines, and his own army was just frittering away out of fear, deserting. So he was so desperate that he felt he was justified in offering a sacrifice instead of waiting until Samuel showed up at the last minute to do it. Perhaps when it would have been too late. And the fact that Saul spared King Agag of the Amalekites and kept the best of the livestock, as he says, for sacrifice to the Lord, seems like an infraction too minor to call for God's attention. But that's not the way that God looked at it. God considered Saul's disobedience to be so significant that he said, I've sought out a man after my own heart. Now, after my own heart means according to my heart, who looks at things the way I look at things. He was referring to David, of course. So Saul lost his kingdom. He lost his dynasty. He lost his life, ultimately, because of this disobedience. Let's move on to the example of the means of transporting the ark. Now, I won't go into all of the background scriptures about this, but God had before directed that the Ark of the Covenant was to be transported or carried by poles being inserted through rings on the bottom of its feet, on his feet. And then the priests were to carry the Ark of the Covenant in that way, with the poles on their shoulders. That's what God said. For some reason, David of all people, and others with him, decided, we don't need to do that. We're going to transport the Ark of the Covenant instead on an ox cart, which is what they did, okay? So while they're making their way toward Jerusalem, carrying the Ark of the Covenant on the ox cart, I don't know if it hits a bump in the road, a rut, or what rock, or what happened, but it started to jolt the Ark of the Covenant, and it started to tip over. And to keep it from falling, a fellow by the name of Uzzah reached up his hand to steady the Ark of the Covenant. Now, some people might say, oh, that's so nice of Uzzah. He did the right. He was not a priest. He was not entitled to lay a finger for any reason on the Ark of the Covenant. And God slew Uzzah for that infraction of his law. Some people might say, listen, really, why? Why? Wasn't Uzzah trying to do a good thing on this occasion? Really, would you have rather had the ark fall over and break open? That would have been worse. So it was justifiable of him on this occasion to reach up and study that ark. Folks, here's an example of how when you start off on the wrong foot to begin with, and what's that? They decided to transport the ark on an ox cart instead of having it carried by the priest. When you start off wrong, you're going to create a situation that later on is going to be problematic for you. Okay. Sometimes it takes a while for the results of the things we do wrong to show up. And that's what happened on this occasion here. You know, let me pause long enough here to observe that not only does it seem like a punishment out of proportion to the sin that Uzzah lost his life for, but also we can observe in 1 Chronicles 15, verse 13. I'll tell you what, let's turn over there and look at that and read it specifically, because this is, I think, a fairly major point that needs to be made here. David, after this incident, after Uzzah's death, is talking about this, and he cites the reason why Uzzah lost his life. And what does he say? This is 1 Chronicles 15, verse 13. Because you did not carry... He's talking to the priest here who should have been carrying the ark. Because you did not carry it at the first, the Lord our God made an outburst on us, for we did not seek Him according to the ordinance. There it is in a nutshell. We did not seek Him according to the ordinance. That is, you can go all the way back to Leviticus or Numbers, wherever the original legislation is, about carrying the ark by poles and on the shoulders of the priest. You can go back to that point. That's the ordinance. You did not seek me according to the ordinance. Now compare that to Hebrews 11, verse 6, where it says, God is a rewarder of who? Those who diligently seek Him. And we find out by comparing these two passages, 1 Chronicles 15, verse 13, where it says that the priest did not seek God according to the order of the Israelites on that occasion, did not seek God according to the ordinance He had given them. And Hebrews 11, verse 6, which says He'll reward those who diligently seek Him. We can define, by comparing these two passages, what it means to seek the Lord. And that is simply to do what He says, to obey Him. Folks, don't talk to me. I don't want anybody to talk to me about their supposed love for the Lord, their respect for the Lord, how they seek the Lord in prayer or whatever, what their feelings about the Lord and His service are. If they're not doing things according to the ordinance, they're not really seeking God. We have to obey God in order to seek Him. The next example, not helping one's brethren. This is a long passage, so I won't read it. But in Matthew 25, the judgment, the latter part of Matthew 25, Jesus describes the judgment scene there. And He points out that there were some actions that some people did not perform toward their brethren. When they were in prison, they did not go and visit with them. When they were sick, they didn't visit with them. When they were ill-clothed, they did not provide them with clothing. When they were hungry, they did not feed them. When they were thirsty, they did not give them water or to drink. And He says, basically, for failing to do those things, you're going to hell. That sounds pretty harsh. Now, again, we would all agree that it's not a very nice thing to neglect your brethren's needs. But, I mean, it's not like you're... I mean, not to give your brother a meal is not exactly equivalent, some people might think, to taking a stick and beating them over the head with it. I mean, sure, it's bad, but that bad? Bad enough to send a person to hell? Well, that's what the Lord says here. And that's my point. Even though these kinds of actions were in the category of neglect and did not involve actively hurting anyone, yet these people would be lost in eternal fire for showing indifference toward the plight of their brethren. Then, a failure to do what's right. Jesus is standing before Pilate in John the 19th chapter, before He's crucified. And he actually says, Pilate, you don't have the greater sin. Someone else does. Does that mean Pilate should feel good about that? Specifically, it says, Jesus answered, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me up to you has the greater sin. You see, Pilate did not want to put Jesus to death. He recognized that it was because of envy that the Jewish authorities had delivered Jesus up to him for crucifixion. He even washed his hands, saying, you know, I'm free of the blood of this, or guilt for the bloodshed involved in this man's death. You're responsible for that. And yet, Pilate was still held guilty. His might not have been the greater sin, but it was still a sin. And failing to do what we can do to intervene and prevent sin is still sin. Pilate failed in that way. James 4, verse 17 says, he who knows the right thing to do and does not do it is guilty of sin. And the last example, Acts 5, verses 1 through 11. Ananias and his wife Sapphira lied about the amount of money that they had given to the church. They sold a piece of property, and they apparently wanted the acclaim and the prestige that would come from having people think that they had given the whole amount they had received from the sale of the land, when actually they had retained some of that money. But yet they put out the word, evidently, that they had given all of it. Well, that's wrong. That's wrong, some people would say. But you know what? I mean, at least they gave some money here. And it's not like they were the first ones ever to lie. You know, it seems like this is something that God could have overlooked. It's not in the category of big sins. At least he didn't have to take their lives for it. But he did. That's the point. The fact that God slew them for what might be called their little white lie shows that God will not tolerate any lying. Lying is a big deal to God. In conclusion then, let me say, if God cares this much, and this is the way I started off the lesson, if you will recall. If God cares this much about little sins, how will He react to big sins? And Hebrews, the 10th chapter, beginning with verse 28, the writer observes, anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much severer punishment do you think he will deserve who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has insulted the Spirit of grace? Yes, if God deals in these ways as we've seen today in these examples, God deals in this way with little sins, or what people call little sins, what will he do with those who are guilty of what might be called big sins? Yes, it seriously jeopardizes or casts into doubt a person's salvation to assume that the sin that he would like to commit is one about which God really doesn't care that much. So we've got, as Christians, to foster the desire to avoid every kind of sin. Identify all sin that might be in our lives. Rid ourselves of all kinds of sins, regardless of whether people might think they're big or little. Regardless of their size or their apparent seriousness. Let's make it our business, our ambition, to rid our lives of all kinds of sin. It might be that there's at least one person here today who would recognize that, you know, he or she has been guilty of big and little sins and everything in between, so to speak, and desires to be rid of them by the blood of Jesus Christ. Come forward in faith and in repentance. Confess your faith in Jesus as the Son of God and be baptized into Christ that you might there make contact with the blood of Christ and be cleansed of your sins. If you're guilty of sin since that point, even sin which has brought reproach upon the Lord or His Word or His church, and you want to let us know that you're sorry for that, the blood of Christ still flows for your forgiveness. We want you to know that. We would happily receive you if you wish to come forward and make these things known. Won't you stand as together we sing together for your encouragement.